Well, g'day and welcome everyone to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Jamie Q. Roberts, who is the author of a soon-to-be-published book called The Intellectual Dark Web, A History and Possible Future. Jamie is a lecturer in the Department of Government and International Relations at the University of Sydney. He specialises in international relations with a focus on international security. More broadly, he is a first principles political philosopher who is interested in the relationship between the individual and the group and the nature of progress and the creation of knowledge. Today we discuss what he means by the intellectual dark web and whether that term is still useful, who and what should be included in that definition and who should not, what unites and what differences there are on the online right, whether there's any hope that the new media will lead to more dynamic discussions and reinvigorate our universities and traditional media, and what the future might hold generally for new media and the alt-right or intellectual dark web. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome Jamie Q. Roberts to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Congratulations on your book, The Intellectual Dark Web, A History and Possible Future, which is going to be released globally on the 17th of March, I understand. But correct me if I'm wrong, but it was actually previously published and then had to be pulled, right?
Yeah, the book was published early last year by an academic publisher. I guess I won't name names just in case, but yeah, it came out. It was out for 2 weeks. And then I got the email. There's been complaints. We've had to pull it from sales. And of course, I say, who complained? What were the complaints? Silence. But the book was investigated and it was found that it couldn't return to the shelves in its current form and would need significant changes. And after a bit of back and forth, yes, we parted ways. So, I was lucky enough to find another publisher. US publisher Pitchstone, which I'm very happy about. The book lives to fight another day.
So you weren't given any, substantive reasons why the book was pulled. It wasn't because, you know, there were any threats of defamation or anything along those lines. I've read through the one that is to be released on the 17th of March. Is there any difference between that version and the one that was originally, the one that was pulled?
The only real difference is the new preface and maybe a few typos that got fixed.
Yeah.
I think the academic publisher, I think they played their cards very close to their chest, and I think in that sense they did a good job. It wasn't the substance of the complaint that was ultimately what was wrong with the book. It was apparently that it didn't engage sufficiently with, you know, theory. So the idea was that we then work through every chapter and put more theory in. And which of course is pretty ironic because that's one of the problems that the book complains about. Yeah. I know what they mean when they say they want you to engage with theory. You know, you've got to start packing it with names and engaging with it. And if I then spent all my time, which I imagine I would be doing, critiquing the theory, to put it mildly, that probably wouldn't do either. So when they say you have to engage with theory, I mean, it's all implied, but usually a degree of homage is required, all that sort of thing. So essentially, before you know it, you've effectively written a completely different book and you've said nothing that you want to say, which, you know, all of this is implied. But having been in academia for 20, 25 years, I know how it works. So, yeah.
Yeah. And part of what you are critiquing in the book is the
the stale conventional approach that academia has and the refusal to engage with fresh ideas and getting bogged down in, you know, this theory and overly academic prose. What prompted you to write the book? Maybe I'll ask it more directly.
I first ran afoul of postmodernism and identity politics long, long ago. 2002 was my first encounter when I was writing my honors thesis. I was writing about gender and men and women, which interests me a lot and actually will hopefully be the topic of my next book. And my supervisor back in the day insisted that I start my dissertation by denouncing myself. I mean, obviously she didn't say denounce myself, but I had to foreground my male identity and blah, blah, blah. And I was just thinking, this doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, maybe you don't like my arguments. Maybe my reasoning's bad. Fine. You know, who knows? But that's what I should be judged on. And so I remember thinking, no, I'm not doing that. Doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't change the nature of my arguments in any way. And so that didn't go well. And then, you know, the more time I spend at uni, because I mean, I've always been pretty keen to be a uni type because I don't know, love of truth, something like that. The true, the good, the beautiful, like it's just something I feel really compelled to pursuing. And so it was a sort of a natural fit for me. But yeah, the longer I spent at uni, the more I just discovered that there was just any number of things you cannot talk about. Maybe most conspicuous of which being the whole academic complex, which seemed not entirely, but to a considerable extent, a bit of a sham where everyone's just sort of trading ideas and no one's really discussing anything and everyone just climbs the hierarchy. And, you know, to my sort of naive, idealistic 20-something self, I was thinking, guys, folks, can't you see the whole system's broken? This whole thing's a sham. You're all doing it wrong. This is not right. And so I kind of wrote my PhD thesis about that. But I mean, you know, eventually I sort of realized that, this is the way of academia. It's the way of the world in many ways. And so I was always sort of trying to battle against it, in Sydney, Australia, and really felt a bit like I was the only person who was seeing the problem and feeling like, you know, the mad person or the sane person amongst mad people, whatever. And and I tried to build up my own ideas of critiquing postmodernism and tried to sort of, you know, develop some very first principles thinking about why truth matters and reasoning and evidence. And I sort of stumbled on badly for the best part of 10 years. And then, of course, this whole YouTube phenomenon, podcast phenomenon thing exploded around 2015, 2016. And suddenly I discovered there was just an entire cast of characters who were everyone had seen exactly the same thing. We're all making the same points. The problem was global. It was everywhere. It was spilling out into the wider world. And so when I fell into an academic position at Sydney University, which is another story, I thought this is absolutely the book that needs to be written. I mean, these are people who are striking at the corruption in academia, in media. And, you know, it's now spilled into the corporate world. It's in our schools and it all has this kind of postmodern identity politics root. And I just thought this is the intellectual / free speech movement of our times. And so, of course, it needs a book to be written about it, which draws all these ideas together. That's my story and also why I wrote the book.
So the title of the book, The Intellectual Dark Web, to me, that term's a little bit dated, as I think you acknowledge, right? Because it came out in about 2018 or thereabouts, popularized by then New York Times columnist Barry Weiss. What do you mean by the term? Is the book trying to just explain a period of time that existed from about 2016 to 2018 to 20 or thereabouts, or is it being used for something broader?
Definitely broader. I mean, it's focused on that 4-year period because that was the real heyday of what was called the intellectual dark web. I mean, yeah, I get that the title's a little dated, and I mean, I've kind of talked to my publisher and pondered subtitles where you mentioned people's names like Rogan and Peterson and all that, which I thought would be better. But in the end, we went with a sort of shorter, snappier title. It is a little dated, but yeah, it's a key moment in intellectual history and sort of public intellectual history. But the ideas, as I've tried to demonstrate in the book, go back a very long way. I mean, they're eternal in many ways. They go back to through Nietzsche, Shakespeare, Plato. So the idea as well is to, discuss broader Enlightenment values, let's say, but within the context of this, you know, particular movement, something like that. But I mean, as I also say in the preface, and as I wrote in an article last year in The Conversation, these ideas have now percolated through sufficiently that effectively they underpin a significant part of Trump's presidency. And you hear Javier Milei talking, he's saying this stuff as well. So it's kind of made its way from YouTube podcast world into mainstream political discourse, which is no small thing.
Yeah. I think this attempt to provide a retrospective or an anthology about this particular phenomenon, the online right, the intellectual dark web, whatever you want to call it, is very useful because there still is a massive gap between those that are incredibly familiar with all the internet lore and the discussions and the controversies over the last, let's call it 10 years. And those that aren't spending time, which is still a large percentage of the population who get their news from conventional sources, which includes large swathes of our political class and journalists and university lecturers who probably, I mean, the clearest example in recent times was the chairman of the ABC when he criticized Joe Rogan. And it was quite clear that that guy had no real familiarity with, the largest, most popular podcaster on the planet. He was describing him as though it's some sort of 90s shock jock talkback type, which is simply not accurate. And anyway, we can go well into that. But I just sometimes feel when I chat to my, online writing buddies that they don't always have a proper appreciation about where the kind of center of gravity still is politically and intellectually in the country.
Yes.
Quickly and onto the next controversy and can barely remember what happened last week, let alone that. The only other book that I've read, which was very early days, and I'm not sure that attempted to do something similar, was that Angela Nagle's Kill All Normies. Have you heard of that one?
I know the title, but what year, sorry?
That was 2017. So that was very early days. And kind of was written on the back of the Gamergate controversy and the like. But
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's all part of it. The Gamergate thing's part of it. That's when identity politics started entering video games. There's many. I mean, but look, as I even say in the book, it goes back to Steven Pinker and the Blank Slate, which was somewhere around 2000 or 2001. But even the scientist fellow Sokol, who wrote the hoax article in the late 90s. So, I mean, there are all sorts of, there have been all sorts of interventions in this over the decades. So, it is almost like, so when I think about the generations of all this, it's almost like still the problem never quite goes away. And every 5 years or few years, the opposition to it kind of reforms, develops new terms, some more books are written. It's almost an eternal struggle.
But have there been any other books that have attempted to do what you're doing in this book?
One of the most impressive books is Cynical Theories by Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay. So whenever that was, 2018, 2019. So Helen Pluckrose, James Lindsay, Peter Boghossian did the Grievance Studies hoax where they wrote all the fake papers. And their book, Cynical Theories, is remarkably good. It's not like a history of the intellectual dark web. It's more like a takedown of what we broadly call postmodern ideas. So, I mean, what I'm doing, trying to provide like a quite a neat, you know, encapsulation of all these key ideas. It's sort of different, but there are a number of books that are throwing punches. It's similar kind of epistemological punches.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit, I must say, when I was reading it. And I haven't read anything which categorically tries to trace the history like you've done of a particular period. It reminded me a little bit of like reading a history of rock, because you're tracing all these bands yeah. and where they arrived and these names.
Yeah, I know, right?
And essentially, I know some of the people that read it will be like, nah, that's not right. And, you know, they weren't cool or they were cooler and this, that, and the other.
It has that similar
type of thing where these online public intellectuals who almost taken the place of the rock stars of I don't know, the 80s and 70s and stuff. Getting down to the nuts and bolts, and because I know people will probably take exception to some of the people in this list, but who do you think forms part of the kind of intellectual dark web?
Yeah, the consensus was pretty strong at the time, you know, when everyone was talking about it. It was, you know, definitely Joe Rogan's at the heart because he popularized so many of these people on his podcast, even if some of them were already successful in their own right, like Sam Harris. But certainly Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson's the most significant figure. I mean, when I was writing the book and going through the chapters, I mean, I could have almost written the whole book just with Jordan Peterson. I mean, okay, that's a bit of an overstatement, but he covered so much of this territory. But yeah, Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, Eric and Brett Weinstein were major figures. Eric Weinstein coined the term intellectual dark web, and he's still, you know, all over the internet world with his kind of trying to, you know, walk the tightrope between left and right, you know, trying to keep an open mind perspective. Dave Rubin, I talk less about him in the book, but he was a figure, he gave a platform to a lot of these people. Claire Lehman, the Australian, founder of Quillette. So I don't talk about her that much in the book, but, you know, the publication Quillette was very important for opening up discussion, especially about things like, you know, human nature, you know, that sort of thing. So they're core figures. And then there's another, I mean, it gets more and more debatable. You know, Douglas Murray, Heather Hying, definitely Jonathan Haidt, Steven Pinker, Elon Musk, without question, which is interesting. But and then there's just more and more people who you can argue about, Glenn Lowry, John McWhorter. But basically, I feel like it's a little arbitrary, but my criteria is essentially, okay, are they talking about this broad collection of ideas? Do they appear on Joe Rogan or related podcasts? Do they talk about each other? So, yeah, it's a little loose. It's a little debatable, but there are a number of figures which you can say, yeah, pretty much.
You write that a large part of those within the quote-unquote intellectual dark web can be classed as classical liberals.
Yes.
And to me, looking at that list, it's sort of Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson are a bit their own thing, but it's the Daily Wire, Free Press, The Bulwark, Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, Quillette, SET. And I'm just wondering, I feel like they exist as a subset of all that's going on the, you know, quote-unquote online right, but those anti-Marxist liberals aren't the complete, would be just to hold those guys up as the only example of what's going on the online right is probably not presenting the full picture, right? How do you distinguish between those guys and some of the, you know, more iconoclastic Nietzschean types or red pill men or the paleocon normie types? Are they just considered too far beyond the pale, or are they not useful, or you have to draw the line somewhere? Or why do you, because they are, I feel like they are influential, but they're not within, you don't include them really within the definition.
I think there's links with any number of groups, ideas, figures, but I mean, part of the list I generated was looking at a few other lists at the time. So, I mean, it's part of that. And I looked through the list, I think, yes, yes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as I was saying before, a fair chunk of it is association.
Mm-hmm.
A fair chunk of it is the sense that these people were regularly appearing on each other's podcasts together, talking with each other. You know, there's a classic photo that Joe Rogan took where these core figures, minus one or two, were actually out to dinner together. And so there is a sense that yeah, even though there are any number of other figures who are talking about related ideas, there was an association between all of these people, like quite a literal association. So that's what you know, largely inspired it. The selection of people.
There's also something, at least within that set, something that distinguishes them from, say, I don't know, Milton Friedman type classic liberals, which you wouldn't describe as intellectual dark web. It's a willingness to discuss differences between the sexes, difference between racial differences, the influence on class, and just simply reject. It's in some ways it's a rejection, right, of the critical race theory, intersectionalism, yes, and all the other stuff that has been rammed down our throats at the university and through the press as well. I would say over that period of time,
this
was the initial kind of fight back that was occurring in those early days. What seems like early days, 8 years ago now. Yeah,
yeah, the initial fight back. Yes.
Mm.
Sorry. I was just going to say, interestingly, I mean, on economic matters, certainly back in the day, they were a lot looser. So you had people who felt like they were much more to the left, more in favor of bigger governments, you know, public hospitals, public schools, you know, all that sort of thing. That stuff's not that strange. And then, yeah, to people, you know, people more on the right, the Ben Shapiro. So economically, they were quite diverse. But the unification certainly came on the things that you said, like attitudes to men and women, the idea that there are biological differences between men and women, not just physical, but that also affect psychology at the population level, race issues. So, yeah, it was more these, yeah, and definitely, yeah, anti-postmodernism, pro-enlightenment values. So it was this collection of ideas, much more so than economics, interestingly enough, that united the group.
Yeah. There's people you don't include, right, which have become major media cultural figures. And I'll just run through some of them. I mean, Tucker Carlson isn't included. J.D.
Do you want me to talk about each one?
And you decide which ones you want to talk about. It's like the history of rock. You know, you can talk about.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
So there's Tucker, there's Trump himself, who was like, you know, basically used a Twitter account to tweet his way into the presidency the first time. There's 4chan, there's Chris Rufo, there's Helen Andrews from the American Conservative. There's the Anons, because I think everyone you mentioned in your book, you know, that you do by name, but there's an incredibly influential number of people who tweet under anonymous handles. And, you know, some of them are some of the brightest guys or gals around who out there. And I feel like their influence has been significant over the last 8 years as well, right? Take a pick of any of those and let me know what you think.
I'll see how I go. Tucker Carlson's an interesting one. I've definitely considered him. I wrote this book largely in early 2023, and so then all the finishing up happened late 2023, came out 2024, got cancelled, found another publisher, it's now 2025. So in some ways it's a bit, I've changed almost nothing about it other than the preface. So yeah, in some way that some of these figures are new figures. I mean, Tucker Carlson was on Fox for a while and then he went independent. And so yeah, I have pondered myself whether he's a figure like that. My intuition says no. My first thought is not sufficiently intellectual in a sense of carefully weighing evidence. My intuition just feels like he doesn't really fit in the group, even if there is overlap there, but he feels more part of whatever a portion of the right wing is becoming now. For a while there, the intellectual dark web, you've mentioned the internet right. Mm. For a while there, it wasn't clear that the intellectual dark web was on the right. It was potentially centrist. Some within the intellectual dark web were even hoping to reform the left. You know, good luck with that. So yeah, Tucker Carlson, Trump. There are elements, and he's certainly taken on parts of the intellectual dark web platform, but I don't know. I don't really see a careful arguing and picking over a lot of these key issues, even if he's kind of ultimately taken them on. There's overlap.
Do you see much of a difference between the intellectual dark web, or the ones that you consider under that label, and say the people who are on the podium at the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship recently in London, which included Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson and Barry Weiss and the rest of them? They've come out of the dark in a sense, really.
Yeah, I mean, I say that in the preface as well. The intellectual dark web, you know, it ain't dark anymore. Yeah, I noticed that. I think didn't even Eric Weinstein talk there? I
went to the first one. I didn't go to this last version in London.
I couldn't afford it, but the trip to the UK. Mm-hmm. My sense was very much ARC has taken on a huge amount of these figures. So yeah, Jordan Peterson, Konstantin Kyssen is sort of a later arrival. Definitely. ARC feels. I mean, ARC's still still feels a touch more conservative than whatever I think the intellectual dark web might be, but only a touch. I mean, its policies are a bit more locked in, certainly around things like the environment. I think there's a strong overlap between the two. Let's say that.
Yeah, I just feel again that there's a whole what has been very influential on people like Elon Musk and others has been this culture, which I wouldn't I think is separate from those guys you described, which contains that, like, you know, dark detached irony, meme culture, transgressiveness. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat sort of performative reactionariness. Talks about, you know, the dark side of the sexist, like sexual nature and stuff somewhat. And also to me, there's three different categories, broadly speaking, right? There's the anti-Marxist liberals, which I would put the Jordan Peterson and everyone else into, and they're the ones you focus on. And then there's the sort of paleocon, traditional Nat Conny right, who much more focused on things like immigration and national identity and, in a way that the other guy has kind of avoided. I mean, you don't hear Jordan Peterson speaking. He has changed the tune a little, but he's not known for immigration restriction or right. And then there's the typically anon types who are Nietzschean, you know, Bronze Age pervert, hipster, very, very, very wild and interesting, but they are their own sort of separate kind of category entirely. And all of them, uh-huh. I guess if you're going to all put them in the same category, they all just completely reject the existing university mainstream journalist approach to issues. All of them, for all their differences, are on a completely different page to those guys, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there's a broader history to be written, which includes all of these figures, I suppose, and branches out more. I mean, what did you say before, the kind of meme culture? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned 4chan before. Mm. I'm trying to think if I even mentioned 4chan in the book. Maybe not, but I mean, that's even wilder. That's, you know, even more manosphere, you know, in the slightly more Andrew Tate type of way, you know. Whereas I feel like there's very much a feeling in certainly the Jordan Peterson types of trying to walk a middle path, you know. Yeah. So not going too far into that crazy troll world, even though I don't know, even though certain figures do, Michael Malice, yeah, Elon himself. I mean, I think there's an appreciation for it because it's uncensored and it's, yeah, it's irreverent. But yeah, it's not quite at the core.
Yeah, but I feel like, you know, Elon, his Twitter posts and even Trump's Twitter posts do have been influenced by that culture, let's put it that way, right?
And yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Like they're not making classical liberal arguments all the time, you know, high-minded sort of intellectual ones. No. They're putting it out there in a provocative way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. In the book on a few, I mean, what did I mention in the book? South Park did get a mention. Yeah. I even have a short chapter on Rick and Morty, which I actually think's, the piece of popular culture for our age almost. Yeah. So they're a lot more irreverent and memey. So yeah, they're a kind of, yeah, I've definitely brought in a little bit of that into the discussion. But yeah, I mean, there's, what can I say? There's always more to say. There's always more to draw. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost as though online, the South Park humor, which was pretty irreverent and all the right back in the day, that's just completely migrated from the TV set into the online world in a sense, right? Because you just don't, there was no spin-offs of South Park on TV. It was just a one-off thing, and then it kind of and then everyone started to like make the same sort of snarky, you know, irreverent jokes online or on Twitter or through other means. And South Park, like Team America, that movie that came out by the guys behind South Park, it's almost sort of mind-blowing to think. I don't think that could be produced and put out there now, right? In the cinemas, but it could certainly appear on a YouTube channel or online. I mean, it would be, and probably get heaps of views.
Yeah. I mean, South Park's so interesting because, I mean, when I reflect on the book, I almost regret not saying more about it because so much of the stuff that, you know, whatever you might say, intellectual dark web or related figures have been on about, South Park was almost always onto it first. 5, sometimes 10 years beforehand, making the kind of critiques. It's kind of been the countercultural commentary of this. It's now almost 30 years, just always ticking along in the background, you know, always complaining about PC culture, you know, all the crazy paradoxes of the transgender movement, whilst also. Like with Team America, being able to critique the right and the warmongering, and it's been a voice of. am I allowed to swear? By the way,
go for it. Yeah, that's all right. I'll edit it out.
I'm quoting, but I put this in the new preface, and I feel like it does sum up a lot of what I'm talking about. South Park. I think it was Matt Stone said, you know, when people are saying, well, "What's your politics?" and he says, "Well, we hate conservatives, but we fucking hate liberals."
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's actually pretty good. Cause it's like, yeah, stuffy conservatives were the kind of people I was against in the 90s, you know, when I was, you know, anti-Christianity, anti-conservative, free speech, you know? And I don't know, they exist a lot less these days. Like whatever conservatism is, it's much less that these days. But yeah, but then as the years have rolled on, it's the excesses of the left, which are even more painful. So it's like, well, yeah, there are critiques of the right to be made, but the left's frankly even more annoying. And so I feel like, yeah, South Park's kind of nailed that for 25 years, and it captures the feeling of the intellectual dark web and many besides.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely some critiques to me made of what was referred to, you know, conservative ink. And the whole fact that it was called the alt-right was, you know, an alternative to the existing right. It was very much, there's very much born of a dissatisfaction with, you know, George W. Bush or that normie conservatism.
Yeah, normie country club type stuff.
Or just, I don't know, deep fried, kind of unreflective, let's do what we did in the 80s because wasn't Reagan great Margaret Thatcher tribute band type of stuff, and not actually, yes. you know, understanding what time it's at and how issues need to be different, and that still goes on. Do you think there's a way? And this is probably overly optimistic, and I'm sure I can anticipate your response. But do you think there's a way that what is happening in the online right or intellectual dark web, whatever you want to call it, new media can reinvigorate the universities and the traditional institutions of learning?
Oh, my goodness. I was just listening to a podcast with Alan Davidson and Peter Boghossian, who I'm fortunately be talking to in a little while, talking about this. And, I mean, they talked about it for an hour and a half. I mean, at some point, that was the hope. At some point, but, you know, I teach at university, and if I don't talk about these ideas, I do pretty well. My courses get well reviewed by the students. I wade into this. I start talking about cancel culture. I push a lot harder on what we could call postmodern versus enlightenment epistemology. if I even say the trans word, you know, the T word. Oh, yeah. Your course evaluations plummet. You know, you get, I don't know, denounced in one way or another by students. I mean, you know, fair chunk of my colleagues. I don't know what to say about that. But like it's like I'm trying to be as brave as I can be given whatever constitution I was born with. The rot goes very deep, which I mean I could talk about it for a long time. Yeah. And even beginning to address it is very hard in so many ways. Like even if I tell students, which I do, like if I'm supervising an honor student or something and I'm saying the method they're telling you is just rubbish. Like it's not even a method. You're just writing 3,000 words about stuff. So it looks like you have a method, but it's not, it doesn't inform what you're doing. And it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. Even if I try to just give them what is ultimately like common sense advice, I'll be disadvantaging the students because so many of the markers are looking for certain signals. Mm. And so even forget my epistemological battles. And so I have to say to the students, right, this is what I think. I've been working on this for 25 years. Here are all my arguments. I think they're pretty good. Let me know, you know, we can talk about it. But if you go with this stuff, you'll probably be disadvantaged. Like it's just, that's just one thought that came to mind. But how is this ever going to feed back in? I mean, so many people now are complaining about this. It's so widespread. And from what I can tell within the university, you know, being there, I have no idea how this is ever going to change. I mean, we've got so many people at the professor level whose whole careers and lives have been built on identity politics, postmodern epistemology, or even if they're not exactly writing about that, it's still just the entire water that they swim in. And so, there's just any number of things they're not going to change. So it's, I despair. People often talk about we need to start new institutions. Okay, great. That takes a long time. Universities in Australia, at least, still have a huge amount of gravitas. That's where everyone still goes. My sense is that students, certainly in the arts and social sciences where I teach, are getting about a third of an education. I wouldn't say they're getting no education because they do learn some things about the way the world works and theories, but they're basically getting about a third of what they ought to get. They're certainly not learning proper critical thinking skills. I do not know. Like I'm on leave at the moment. When I head back, I've made a strong mental commitment to fighting every step of the way. Mm. I'd be surprised if I even last another 6 months.
Outrageous, man, and strength to your hand for raising it or pushing through, because people don't
appreciate
the struggle. I mean, what percentage do you think of professors in the arts and culture portions of the university have, I don't know, listened to a Joe Rogan podcast or a Jordan Peterson YouTube I mean, do they even engage with it? Because there used to be a tradition, at least there used to be people in, that you could point to internationally. And I think you mentioned her, Camille Paglia types, who are,
yes.
They come from a sort of, might have been a Marxist or a leftist tradition, but they were much more open to mixing it and interested in the culture itself, right?
They're great. Passionate discussers. Hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, this is the legacy of postmodernism. And I mean, I spend so much time trying to work out how to say this as efficiently as possible. Hmm. And I came across a quote by Mearsheimer, the international relations guy who we all know with his various, changing ideas. But he said it very, very well, unfortunately, 20 years ago. He said, I'm paraphrasing, that Cold War idealists, pre-1990, whatever, their idea of winning was having the best argument, which is great. I ultimately don't know what the right thing to think is about a number of matters. I want to hear a range of arguments, whatever. But anyway, the point is, you have the best argument. That's still in the Enlightenment tradition, reasoning and evidence. And he says, but now, the way you win is by having the only argument. And so the whole postmodern thing, by saying that there either is no reality or we don't have access to reality or reality or truth is entirely configured by power, that's the whole background within which this whole world exists. And so what that means then is that as long as you can associate yourself with those without power, this is like the Nietzschean idea of slave morality. As long as you can find some way to associate yourself with the oppressed, then effectively you can say whatever you want and you don't need reasoning and evidence because they're part of the Enlightenment tradition. So, we've kind of managed to create this whole corrupt epistemology where, you associate with the less powerful, then you can say what you want, and if someone comes along and challenges that, then they're necessarily part of the powerful group, and then they can be dismissed even before you hear the reasoning and evidence. So hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. But basically the postmodern legacy has found a way to dismiss argument and discussion because they carry the taint of power. And so this is what makes it so unbelievably hard to ever get anywhere. Sorry, what was the question you said? Sorry.
Oh, I just whether the universities could be reinvigorated. I mean,
but there's something.
I mean, maybe I'll lead on because it's not just the universities. They're not just they are academics. They have a certain kind of cachet, some of them at least, but others are just sort of interesting people like Joe Rogan, right? Who has a plain speaking style, but is. And you had a nice line in your book where you said, Joe Rogan, who's at the heart of the dark web, whatever you want to call it, time and time again gets to the point using plain and efficient language. And he said the following about the intellectual dark web: people are starved for controversial opinions and they're starved for an actual conversation. I mean, I think that's so true, because the tendency among the left or whatever is to simply shut it down if they don't like it. The right can be pretty brutal and direct and but they also, I feel, again, broadly speaking, can be forgiving if you recognize, you take on board and sort of are authentic and change in a sense. Whereas the left just cancel.
Yeah, that's it.
And you are never forgiven if you stray away from the doctrinaire line. Even though they start off talking about, inclusiveness and tolerance and all the rest of it, it's just it's not the way they operate.
So that's like the whole postmodern legacy has allowed that to occur. You can just cancel powerful bad speech. I feel like the right is. I mean, the funny thing is, I spent much of my adult life on the left, but it's all of this just horrific stuff which has driven me away. But I feel like with the right now, I can talk, I can have a discussion, I can disagree, and that's fine. I don't feel like I'm going to be denounced or cancelled for wading into these things. But that's right. You were saying before, don't these academics want to talk? Don't they want to discuss? Well, when your whole career is, I knew there was something there. When your whole career is built on like very, very flimsy and dodgy assumptions. I mean, when you say we have no access to reality, there is no truth, then the very, you know, there's so many obvious rejoinders like, well, why should you be getting paid? You know, shouldn't you resign now and go fishing? Any number of those things. And so everything's just this crazy back and forth paradoxes. And so when you have careers or even just sort of social circles which are built on this stuff, of course you can't talk because you shine any light on it. And humans, I think we're, you know, we are naturally inclined towards truth and reason, certainly in the world we are now. But yeah, you shine any light on this and it just becomes ridiculous. So of course you just have to, you have to shut down. And so, yeah, that's the, that's been the staggering decline of the left over the last 20 odd years.
Yeah. The intellectual dark web, you trace to Barry Weiss using the term in a New York Times article in 2000, whatever it was, 18. And
18,
then,
yeah.
Yeah. And then 2020. Is it worth talking about that period between 2020 and 2024? Because I feel like some of those people that were very outspoken on particular issues kind of went to ground a bit, right? They well, Jordan Peterson just sort of had some sort of illness and vacated the field. Yes. But others, I was disappointed in their commitment to free speech during COVID times and their critical
COVID
things. Yeah, and I was critical of them. You know, also on, you can be wrong, but ask critical questions about the 2020 election as well without being considered completely beyond the pale. I just felt like their kind of, their previous, you know, critical free speech, let's talk about anything, was they just didn't want to discuss something. Like Douglas Murray, he just didn't discuss COVID. You know, Jordan Peterson came late to the party, very late to the party. I guess that's the problem with these guys who become more mainstream and known. They have a little bit more to lose, whereas the ones who are on the edge take greater risk. And maybe that's just an inherent dynamic in the whole media industry, right? But do you also think, Jamie, that there has, and this is something that is always muttered about, that there has been not just, you know, overt kicking people off Twitter and shadow banning and the like, but there's been more manipulation of the online right, or at least potential manipulation of the online right, both governments and commercial interests? Or do you think that that's something that is a risk or that exists? Or yeah, I'd just be interested in your views.
Okay, so, I mean, so you're talking about corruption following success, essentially. Yeah. So I address that.
I'm not alleging anything. I mean, I just don't know.
It's interesting. Like, in many ways, I wrote my PhD thesis about this because I was looking around the uni and I couldn't understand why everyone was so corrupt. And so I was just trying to, to ponder these issues very deeply from a human nature point of view. And I think it's just an eternal process. Like, I start the book with the Robespierre quotation and it's like a bit of a sneaky one, but, you know, it's the classic example, you know. Maybe the French Revolution was needed, but it sure went in a funny old direction. I think basically everyone is subject to these forces. You know, you come out blazing and with principles, and then, as you say, you've got more to lose. And the money flows, my goodness. And especially if you've had a life of struggle, a life in the wilderness, and finally people want to hear what you have to say. And yeah, the money flows. My goodness. So seductive. In like the 5% chance I become successful, I'm kind of like mentally prepping for, you know, for all of that.
Well, remember us little guys when we knew you, when you hadn't hit the,
I just did want to say a few words about the COVID thing. The COVID thing was fascinating because, I learned quite a bit about myself early on in COVID because I did discover that I there was something in me which was just deeply skeptical. I remember when the death rates first were coming out and they were looking like 3 or 4%. And this was even quite close in. And I remember saying to my wife at the time, I don't know, it's just like, wait, this doesn't stack up with this and this and this and this and this. And it's like, surely it's like maybe it's more like an order of magnitude less than that. It's probably 0.2 because they're not counting this. And this was just speculating. But if you said that, you're gone. And this is just speculating about death rates. And like, I emphasize speculating. Obviously, everyone now talks about the lab leak hype thing. Like, how is it racist to say it came from a lab? I mean, in my mind, it's almost more racist to say it comes from the wet market, because you're saying, well, look at the Chinese. They eat weird food, you know?
Yeah. It was just a situation, and we could talk about COVID if the cows come home, but it was just a situation where reasonable people, I feel like I'm reasonable, you're reasonable, who were analyzing a multifactorial problem, had a different take on it and proposing a reasonable solution. You know, take the vaccine if you're over 70, and that's where the real risk was, but why force the rest of the population? Does it really cause tremendous, all these issues, are the death rates really, when properly adjusted? What about Sweden? I mean, you know the drill, right?
What about Sweden? I know, trade-offs. I mean, there was like one or two people who were willing to talk about trade-offs. It's like everything in life's a trade-off. So we're trading off serious economic problems, which will have...
Yeah.
Frankly, we're arguably still suffering. The cost of living crisis now is, you know, I mean, I'm no great economist, but arguably, you know, we can trace that to, you know, supply shortages during COVID, government spending, maybe anyway. But I mean, there's any number of knock-on effects which will cause deaths and anything else. I mean, all of these basic things which should have just been worth discussing.
Well, should have been a more rigorous debate by people. Good faith, informed opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't. And even today, there's a stigma attached with, you know, people who, you know, I think were right at the time, but, you know, they're still painted as a bit crazy. The media, it's not just academia, it's the media as well, right? And you have that classic interview that Jordan Peterson does with Cathy Newman from the BBC. Where, and it's been turned into a meme, you know, where she goes, what you're saying is, and basically is saying something completely different to what he's making. You know, the online right or the intellectual dark web, it's journalism at one level, right? It's interesting journalism, and it's of a kind that probably existed back in the day, where you had lots of muckraking kind of independent types. And I'm sort of hopeful that is sort of what we're returning to, that the corporate media stuff is just sort of increasingly ignored and people go to these types of characters to get this, you know, really interesting takes on things. And if they fight with each other, so much the better. It makes for more interesting discussion and all the rest of it. But... I'm an old China guy, and I, you know, well versed in Mao quotes and stuff. You know, and there was a famous period where Mao said, "Let a thousand flowers bloom, let a thousand schools of thought contend," and that happened for about a year before cracking down on everyone and sending them all to jail. And I'm just wondering where this does end, because while we are now experiencing a lot more freedom with, you know, Elon owning Twitter and Trump in the White House, and people aren't, I believe, getting cancelled and shadow banned like they once did. It's possible that things change, and it's already not great. I mean, you know, like you said, you still struggle at university. It's not as though we live in a, you know, everything's changed and we live in a free age. How do you think it could go dark, darker than it is now?
I mean, this is kind of like a version of the peak woke question, maybe. I directly after Trump got in, I felt there was this great, I mean, you know, my friends who, you know, more politically sympathetic, you know, they were saying, oh yeah, I was at a pub in the Inner West, you know, in the Inner West in Sydney's like, you know, woke heartland, you know, and there were guys saying, oh, wow, finally I can say this, this and this. Like, you know, people, there was that great kind of sigh of relief that the censor was off everyone's shoulders. I can make jokes again, you know, Barry Weiss talked about this. But I, honestly, when I feel the, you know, whatever the political waters, even in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I feel like, I don't know, like since Doja's really got going, which seems, I mean, okay, I wouldn't say relatively innocuous, but, you know, cutting government spending, I don't know, there's something to be said for it. But I just, I don't know, even now I feel like the woke left, whatever we want to call it, is reforming and doubling down. That's my sense just the, from the last few weeks.
Still do so, dominate the institutions, the major, you know, institutions of learning, of science, of journalism. They, you know, they still have the commanding heights of the economy.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly in Australia, right? I feel like, do you feel that like Australia, apart from Claire, who has run Quillette and has certainly, you know, asked some interesting questions that, that haven't been asked and has a different take and has forged out a niche for herself. Obviously, people have criticisms of Claire. You know, I've tried to be friends with everyone. But you know, do you think we're a little bit, even more so in Australia, behind in this area?
It's a good question, the status of Australia, because I swim so much in US and to a degree, you know, UK politics with all of this stuff. Yeah, I mean, what's the term cultural cringe? Maybe that's got something to do with it. I don't know. I when I think about all my university experiences, I do feel like there's a sense in which, yeah, like so many Australians still lack a certain courage or boldness, which is so associated with the American spirit of just like, fuck it, this is what I believe in, this is what I'm doing, you know, risk taking. And so when I try to, you know, when I think of, you know, Australia, academia, the broader sphere, it just, it does just sort of feel like, as you say, we are behind, we're drifting along. There's not nearly enough people who are sort of enterprising. I'm not explaining it that well, but I do feel throughout my whole PhD, sorry.
I was just saying, in fairness too, they have the First Amendment. We do have a lot of restrictions on freedom of speech. A lot of things that are said or in the US online would run the risk of serious legal jeopardy here in Australia, which I think is sort of sometimes not fully appreciated when people tell others to speak out, like, you know, understand that, well, yeah, okay, you know, you might lose not just your job, but you get involved in litigation. Moira Deeming, you know, the TERFs, which do feature in the online world, and you do mention them in your book. You know, she was had to get involved in litigation because, you know, she had this crazy opinion that, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but they're a risk to your, as you mentioned too, if you make a statement about, yeah, to that, you know, biological reality, men and women, that places you at risk in corporate Australia, in universities and elsewhere.
Okay, so maybe you're right. Maybe the risk is greater, and I don't know. I'm less sort of conscious of that. Maybe I should be more conscious of that as I speak more publicly. But I do just feel I don't know. I mean, this is just sort of gut response that I often ponder. But the easy life as well. I mean, my goodness, when I think of just collectively so many of the people I've come across in academia over the years, you know, you publish the papers, you say the words. I mean, as a professor now at Sydney Uni, you're on $250,000. That's a lot of money. I don't know. I feel like, you know, Australia is a lucky country. We're a wealthy country. You get into various places, you don't rock the boat. You're going to have a very good life. And I've heard stuff like that in so many different ways. And I don't know. And then even just the mindset, like me personally, I'm highly ambitious. I mean, it's not in like sort of a normal sense, but I mean, I won't talk about it now, but I've got various side projects, which are utterly ridiculous, frankly, but I feel like it's something of like the American spirit. Like it's like, oh, you know, I don't want to just have a comfortable life. I want to do something interesting and bold, you know? And I mean, am I bashing my country too much to feel like there's not, I just don't sense that. I mean, of course there are any number of people we can point to, but as the general spirit of the country just doesn't quite feel like that.
Everyone's too busy paying off their mortgages to devote entrepreneurial or other activities. I mean, maybe that.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm just talking in cliches here, but it is something of the vibe that I feel, which then ultimately means on all of these issues, we just kind of toe the line. We're a little late to adopt it. We're a little late to get rid of it. We drift along. Quite a few people are still unhappy about it, but it's not like we're creating it, you know, like the University of Austin, whatever it is, the new university that they're creating over there with a lot of the intellectual dark web figures. So, I mean, okay, sure, there's not enough money here. We probably need more philanthropy. So that's a limitation, but it's not like that's exactly happening here. So there's I don't know.
Strikes me. Oh, look, I was thinking about you're probably younger than me, but during the 90s, when I was...
I don't know, actually.
Maybe not. Okay, you say? But I don't think there weren't these public intellectual figures. I don't think. There were newspaper columnists that maybe people, you know, followed closely in the same way they follow people on X and stuff, but I just don't think it was the same climate. There was, in the 70s, you had people like Clive James, Germaine Greer, and Robert Hughes and the types.
Yeah, they were figures. Yeah.
Intellectual. But they were overseas. They did have to go overseas to do it.
Yeah, you go to London.
But there is a structural problem here because we're quite successful at journalism, at least in the newspaper industry, media industry, right? We have probably the most successful media proprietor comes from Australia. And we produce journalists, but we don't seem to be. And I think there's a lot of talented, interesting people here, but we could, which should produce the Douglas Murray types or, you know.
Yeah,
But there's a variety of different reasons for that. I don't think it's all just beat up on Australians where, you know, not as smart as the rest of them. I think there's some little, it's a problem to be solved. Mate, I've really enjoyed chatting to you and making the connection because I think we're definitely on the same page and it's been a really interesting discussion. And I think it's a worthwhile.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
Worthwhile one that hopefully punches through into the normie press or the mainstream press here in Australia and gets people thinking about what could be, right? And what truly intellectual activity looks like both in our universities and in our media ecosystem. So
it could be so amazing. We could go so much further. I mean, so much is possible if we can find a way to reform. Like it's, yeah, so much.
Yeah, well, that is a good. That's what you want, right? You want a moribund institution in need of disruption, and I see it. You see it, and I'm sure, given the right, where the winds blow the right way, it'll take us there, mate. Book launches on the 15th of March. People should 20th. Be able to buy. Oh, sorry, 20th of March on Amazon. They should be able to buy it, and then there's a potential launch in Sydney, which I guess will be made known if people Google it in due course.
Yeah, yeah.
And hopefully you'll get a lot more press out of it and people will read your book and start better understanding
what
is going on in the
absolutely, yeah.
Outside the mainstream press and outside the mainstream universities. Yeah.
All right.
Lovely to chat.
Thank you so much.
Cheers, man. Bye.
Sure. See ya.